Hey, y'all, a couple of quick call-outs before the episode. First of all, this is going up end of February, so pretty soon on March 14th, 2026, is the Revive Conference. This is going to be out at Penn, associated with the Center for Resuscitation Science, which, you know, they do a lot of the research in resuscitative areas. And it's a new conference this year, totally focused on resuscitation, meaning all of the skills and ideas related to taking care of really sick patients. It's a new conference this year, and they wanted us to get the word out, and we're happy to do so because it looks pretty cool. A lot of hands-on skills as well as didactic stuff from a lot of stars. So think about going if you are able to go in person or virtually if not. It's March 14th, and they provided a discount for our listeners if you want to use that. It's RevivePenn, R-E-V-I-V-E-P-E-N-N. That'll give you $75 off. Check it out, revive-conference.com. Second, the Intensive Care Academy, our other program, continues to bustle along. We just dropped a new lesson about mechanical circulatory support in the cardiac ICUs. A lot of really good stuff over there if you haven't seen it. It's a video-based platform for subscribers. Goes really well with this podcast if you're a fan of this. Check it out at icu101.com. CME available as well. Finally, and I'll stop boring you, I will be teaching at a course in April that might interest you, the 23rd and 24th of 2026. CHEST has a new procedural course being offered called Procedural Skills for the Critical Care Clinician, which is a two-day course at their headquarters outside Chicago, which is purely for bedside procedures that you may want to know as an ICU clinician. So great for APPs, also docs who are trying to bone up on these skills, and really anyone who wants procedural skills. And, you know, these can be hard to acquire when you're just floating around hoping to encounter one in the wild. So central lines of all flavors, arterial lines of all sites, chest tubes, paracentesis, thoracentesis, lumbar punctures, placing IOs, and some miscellaneous things such as suturing. Intensive two-day course with a lot of hands-on skills and simulation. And really think about this if you're early career. I think this courses like this are more valuable early on than going to general conferences and things. There's a lot more learning, and it really helps build your foundation. Check it out at the CHEST website. I'll put a link in the show notes, or just search for that name, Procedural Skills for the Critical Care Clinician, and I hope to see you there. On to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Thanks for coming back with us, and we're going to talk a little bit today, not about a case in particular, but about something a little more administrative. And before you turn it off and say, oh, that sounds awful, I think this is a really important topic, and it's a topic that we don't probably talk enough about. One thing I notice is that when my students, when I teach at Georgetown, have no concept of how this stuff works. And this is something we always try to hit with them in their kind of last semester of school, and they're always sort of caught off guard. So we thought we would talk about it, and the topic at hand is credentialing. And those of you who are in practice know a little bit maybe about this, right? I don't think those of us who practice really understand it. We just know there's a bunch of forms you have to fill out. You have to give it to some people. And it seems to be a nebulous, complex process designed to make me never want to do it again. So I'm not going to quit and go get a different job because I don't want to be credentialed at another place.
It's like something confusing and unpleasant that happens every once in a while. Then you black out and assume that it's never going to happen again until it does. And then you're like, oh boy, this again.
But, you know, like most things in life that we don't really understand, part of it is that we just don't understand it, right? There is a method to the madness, theoretically. Maybe we'll find out today that there isn't, that this is all just a big joke on us.
Albeit also madness to the method, probably.
Yeah, but we figured we probably should enlist someone who knows more about it than Brandon and I. We could just sit here and talk about what a pain it is, but probably not going to get us anywhere. We asked Christopher Newman to come and join us. So, Christopher, welcome to the podcast, and tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and why you know about this stuff.
Sure. Thanks, guys. So, yeah, I mean, as someone who lives most of my life within a healthcare administration, this is obviously super exciting and fun to me, but I recognize that I'm like an N of one. So my name's Chris Newman. I am a PA. I've been practicing since 2002, my entire career in pediatric critical care. And since 2010, I've been at Children's Colorado. I am also an associate professor and vice chair for clinical performance in the Department of Pediatrics at the CU School of Medicine, where I focus a lot on things like operational efficiency. And so essentially have lived most of my career in how healthcare gets delivered. And a huge part of that is credentialing and privileging. I served as a member of the Children's Hospital Colorado Medical Staff Credentialing Committee for about 10 years, the last five of it as co-chair, and have authored both book chapters and articles on issues around credentialing, privileging, and procedural competence.
All right. So I think part of the challenge of this whole process is that not only do people not understand how it works, but they don't even understand like the concepts or like why it exists or what we're even trying to accomplish and even what the words mean. So part of this is going to be a matter of just understanding like some definitions. So if we kind of walk through the process that people usually experience, many times this will start with someone applies for a job, they get accepted for a job, HR gives them a thumbs up, the clinical team's like, oh, we want to hire you, great. And then you enter this process. It's like,
yeah,
it's like passing through the rabbit hole. And the first thing that often happens is you communicate with a medical staffing office, something like that. Let me just first ask, what is that? I mean, that sounds like the Illuminati or something. What is medical? Isn't everyone medical staff in a hospital?
Well, no. Actually, you need to be credentialed and privileged to be a member of the medical staff. So if you think about it, if it's okay, I'm just going to start with those two words, just because I think a lot of people mix them together. Credentialing is essentially verifying that you've done all the necessary steps to be in that hospital. So that's things like you went to a board or to an approved program, you passed your boards, you have the appropriate state license, you have malpractice insurance, all the things that says it's okay that you're inside our building because the hospital is responsible for what happens inside that building. And then privileging is, what are you allowed to do here? So, okay, we've let you through the door. What can you do? Right? Because you don't really want to ask a neurosurgeon to do circumcisions. You need to make sure that I have the appropriate training, education, and legal authority to do specific things. And the medical staff office is really the group that's responsible for all the processes that bring providers into the institution, right? If you're a bedside nurse, you don't go through the medical staff office. If you're in environmental services, you don't go through the medical staff office. But if you are going to make plans, deliver care, order care for patients within the walls of that hospital, they need to ensure that you're competent. They need to ensure you have a legal right to be there, and they need to ensure that you're meeting the various standards that are set by the federal government through CMS or the state government or Joint Commission. All those various groups have rules around what it means to be a member of the medical staff. And so a huge part of what that office does is ensure that they're complying with all the various regulatory entities that tell them, again, what they have to do to ensure you're allowed to be there and then to define what you're allowed to do once you get there.
So, Chris, can I ask a question here real quick about privileging? So you said basically that they're there to ensure that you have the right to do what it is that you're going to be doing, right? Like the neurosurgeon not doing circumcisions, for example. So can I assume then that there are experts who know what you're allowed to do on this? Because like when I was in NP school, it was hammered into us, and I think we tell our students now, you need to know what your scope of practice is as a whatever. I'm an adult gerontology acute care nurse practitioner. As a whatever you are in whatever your state is, what are you allowed to do? Because, you know, I was told stories of, you know, some NP gets hired to work for a physician and a physician says, well, you can do this and this and this, and they don't know because they're physicians and they don't know what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do. Do I need to be concerned about stuff like that, or will the medical staff office know what's cool?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So, one thing to keep in mind is all of these systems were built first and foremost to credential and privilege physicians. And so, by and large, across all 50 United States, the rules that govern how physician practice are the same, right? Mm-hmm. There's no real difference. And there's also huge standardization, right? They have USMLE and they have licensing requirements that are essentially the same across 50 standards. And the quote scope of practice is identical. And then they have all these formal boards, right? So the medical staff can often say, all right, you want to do pediatric critical care. Are you board certified in pediatric critical care? They don't really have to go a lot beyond that for a physician because there's all these ancillary agencies that ensure that that fellowship is accredited, that they pass the relevant boards, et cetera. Where it gets messy is when it comes to APPs because there are 50 state laws, and we say APPs, right? But there's 50 state laws that govern PA practice. There's 50 state laws that govern advanced practice registered nurse practice. And there's a huge variability. And then even beyond that variability, a lot of the rules that govern medical staffs are pretty ambiguous when it comes to non-physicians. You know, joint commission is a lot less clear on what it means than they do when they talk about physicians. So in theory, the job of the medical staff is to ensure that you have the relevant training, experience, licensure, et cetera, to do the thing you are asking to do. Most of the time that the expert is the, you know, I'm in an academic medical center, so I'm a little more familiar with that. My section head has to endorse that he or she approves of me getting this privilege, that they have looked at it as an expert in this area and said yes. But that's also the role of the credentialing committee. The committee is made up of practicing clinicians, and part of their job is to answer that question. So in my example, we had a nurse practitioner who asked for acupuncture privileges. And we're like, I have no idea if a nurse practitioner can do acupuncture, right? So we had to go investigate, and we had to reach out to other states, and we had to reach out to the schools, and we had to say, is there a certifying body for acupuncture that we could rely on? So it's a combination of when there's a rule that exists that's pretty straightforward, the medical staff office will follow that rule. When it gets more ambiguous, they try to find a standard or a body that allows them to say, yes, this third party says that this person is competent to do that.
So just to dial back to definitions, the medical staff consists of physicians and APPs.
Well, the medical staff membership is defined by the institution. So just because this was a recent topic, and I know I live mostly in the pediatric world, but so it's variable. There are medical staffs where it's physician only, and the APPs are considered ancillary staff. There are medical staff where the APPs might be adjunct staff or adjoint staff or associate staff or full staff. The reason that's important is because various regulatory agencies define who's allowed to vote and hold office.
Okay, so all these people are subject to their control, but there are other times when it comes up whether or not you're literally a member of the medical staff, such as whether you can sit on certain committees and things like that.
Yes. And so at our institution, for example, psychologists are a member of the medical staff. We have a wide genetic counselors. We have a variety of specialties that are part of the medical staff. We're also probably on the more liberal, small L, liberal end in terms of who's included in the medical staff because Colorado tends to have relatively little to say about a lot of that.
But let's say you're in a place where APPs, for example, are not considered part of the quote-unquote medical staff for committee membership, voting rights, all that stuff. But they're still governed by the medical staff in terms of credentialing and privileging, right?
Yeah, and that's a joint commission standard. So the joint commission requires that everybody who practices goes through a common pathway. So they're used to, like 20 years ago, they didn't say that. And so like nurse practitioners would actually be credentialed often through a nurse credentialing board within the hospital, but PAs would go through the medical staff. And so Joint Commission realized that that's not a great process. And so they began insisting, I think about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, that there has to be a common pathway for credentialing and privileging that has to be unified within the medical staff.
And that's worth, you know, thinking about, because there are sometimes when, at least administratively, for PAs and NPs, for instance, in our world, are managed in a lot of different ways, but this is, they collapse into one. And separate, of course, from, like you said, the bedside nurses, the respiratory therapists, I mean, basically all the other clinical staff in the hospital, they may or may not have some other processes of ensuring appropriate credentials and things, but it's not managed through medical staffing. It's not part of this process.
That's correct. And the other thing is that the medical staff is not necessarily an employment agreement. So I am privileged to practice at Children's Colorado. I am not an employee of Children's Colorado. So that's the other sort of distinguishing factor is for many, again, this was a system built for physicians, right? Many physicians are not employed by the hospital where they have privileges. So this is a mechanism for the hospital to ensure that people they don't employ are meeting their standards. And it's much simpler if you hire all the nurses, then HR handles a lot of that. But my HR is in the University of Colorado. And so how does the hospital ensure that I'm competent because I'm taking care of patients within their walls without the authority of, well, I can just fire them? Like, they can't fire me. I don't work for them.
So I guess that would be more applicable probably, although you're not private practice, but if you were in a private practice setting where you work for, you know, critical care associates of Smithtown, and you go to four or five different hospitals, you have to be credentialed and privileged at those four or five different hospitals, even though you don't work for them. Versus, I think all three of us, even though you said you're not an employee of the hospital, we all sort of work in a system where the hospital and the medical staff, that's a bad term, I guess, to use because we're confusing it, but are all kind of the same thing.
Well, or the very old days when primary care people would show up at the hospital and take care of their patients. They don't work for the hospital, but they had privileges there.
Well, I think I would actually make a distinction, you know, particularly in academic medicine. You know, I have protections that exist because I'm a publicly employed university faculty. And so I actually think that's one of the areas where credentialing and privileging gets a little tricky. Like, what happens if there's a professionalism complaint about me? Does that go to the what we used to call, you know, I mean, all the names have sort of changed. Does that go through a committee of the medical staff office that evaluates whether that professionalism is impacting my ability to care for patients within the walls of this hospital? Does that go to my university professionalism committee? You know, where is the so I understand there are groups where they're employed by the hospital directly. Mm-hmm. They still have to go through medical staff because the Joint Commission, CMS, et cetera, it's really in some ways protective. We have to do things that don't look like what a normal employee does. There has to be a level of freedom to disagree with your employer when it comes to the delivery of medical care. And so in some ways, all these processes are actually set up to protect us, to make sure that once we've established that we have the appropriate credentials and the appropriate privileges, it also protects our ability to make medical decisions and to follow up with those medical decisions and to disagree and to make individualized decisions. So I think we think of medical staff often as a group of people who want papers from us and then delve into our lives and call our high school guidance counselor to make sure we really went to high school. It's really also there to protect us. These rules are designed to keep us independent and able to really make important decisions where we might disagree.
Right. It reminds me of, you know, every year when you have to do our training on sexual harassment and stuff, they always remind us that even the people in the hospital who are not, don't work for the hospital, are still bound by the same laws around this stuff because it's within those walls. You know, the guy who refills the vending machine can't sexually harass the nurses. The hospital is still responsible for that. Anyone, there's like a certain, if you're here, you're our problem kind of thing.
Exactly.
Credentialing is the process of ensuring that these people have the appropriate training and experience and background to do certain things. And privileging is the process of saying that you are allowed to do those things. So they're obviously related because you want to privilege people only to do things that they have, you know, successfully been credentialed to do. And there's no point in credentialing them for things that they don't need privileges for. But they're separate because they're separate. It's like certification and licensing are sometimes separated. Like I am a certified PA through the NCCPA who I have to take tests from and give my CME and stuff, but they don't license anyone to practice medicine. I'm licensed by the state that I work in. Now, they only license people who are certified and so on, but they are separate processes.
Yeah, somewhat. I think actually both of those two things would fall into credentialing. Credentialing doesn't really say what you can do within the walls of the hospital. It just says you have a right to be there. So it's not really verifying your specific skills. That's really privileging. So it's more along the lines of, do you have the license necessary to call yourself a PA? Did you go to an approved program? Do you have the correct education? So they do a lot of primary source verification. Credentialing is really typically most onerous initially, right? When you initially apply for credentials, the rest of the time, I think we've now gone to a 3-year cycle according to Joint Commission. Every 3 years, they're just saying, did anything change that we have to look at? You know, they're checking with national databases to make sure you didn't commit a crime in the intervening 3 years, et cetera. Privileging is where they say, these are the things you're allowed to do. And that starts at a very basic level. So like at our institution, APPs are privileged in sort of one of four spaces: critical care, acute care, emergency medicine / urgent care, and ambulatory. And then within those, they may have separate privileges that are specific to their practice. And then within that, they may have separate privileges related to procedures. They go like one is step one and the other is step two. And it's really more about your competency as an individual when you get to step two.
I guess to look at those separately, credentialing basically seems like it comes down to ensuring that people are not lying. They said that, I went to high school, college, PA school, medical school, whatever. I did a residency. I'm not a criminal, whatever. And they're like, well, let's see about that. So it seems on the one hand incredibly almost over thorough sometimes, especially because a lot of the things they look at seem to be redundant. In other words, if I went to college, I probably finished high school, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, you still seem to hear about stuff that slips through. I mean, we had someone in DC who was practicing as an OB for like 10 years and never finished residency or medical school or something like that. So it seems like it's the worst of both worlds in the sense that it's like a huge pain in the butt. And nevertheless, stuff still seems to happen. So is the goal basically just to try to reduce the number of, you know, liars, the amount of fraud that's happening?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, there's also regulatory agencies that say you have to do this. And so that you do. But I would take it in a step back, and maybe this is my bias, but, you know, I care for children. And when a parent brings a child to an institution, they're sort of assuming that someone made sure it's okay that the person taking care of them should be there. Because the stakes are so high, you know, we don't make widgets. If you suck at making widgets, you just get a bad widget, and they figure it out pretty quickly. It's really hard to tell if we're not very good at what we're doing. It's really difficult. So maybe we could at least agree that we're legally qualified to be doing it. And it's not, you know, it was a much more onerous process 30 years ago. So much of this is automated now. You know, we're moving towards these compacts where it's pretty easy to verify license from other states. We've moved towards more centralized databases around, you know, it's very easy now to verify that you actually are NCCPA certified, Brandon, relative to 20 years ago, you had to mail them something, they would send a postcard. They just click a button. So a lot of that has really gotten better. But I will also say it's been my experience that the bulk of the work from the medical staff office is not in credentialing. It's in the privileging.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, like, how often does this actually identify some kind of a deficit? But I suppose it's like airport security. I mean, people by and large, don't try to walk through there with a bomb or something because they know there is security. If there was no credentialing process, I mean, there probably would be people who just turn up like, oh, yeah, I'm like a doctor of all kinds of things. Let me work in your place.
Yeah, and imagine if the alternative was you had to de novo determine the competency of every single individual who walked through the door. You'd never get any actual care delivered because you'd be spending the whole time. So this allows, they don't have to know that I'm a good PA because they can say that, well, I went to an approved program. I graduated from that approved program as, you know, the director of my program sent a letter saying I graduated. They know I passed my boards. They know I have a state license. They know I'm qualified for malpractice insurance. Those are also double checks on my competency that they don't then have to reproduce.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, they don't really see it as their job to ensure anyone's clinical competence, except that they meet these standards that are requirements for the job. And presumably, if you meet these things, then it ensures some amount of competence. You could still be incompetent on some more granular level, but that's sort of beyond their ability to...
Yeah, we like to tell students that that's the point. Boards, you know, ensure that you are minimally competent to practice, so... You know, I always tell students, don't stress so much because it's not going to be...
It's a low bar.
You don't have to perform at a super high level to pass your boards. Minimally competent.
That's where ongoing and focused professional practice evaluations come in, which is also the responsibility of the medical staff, right? Now you're here. How do I know you're competent, and how do I know you have ongoing competence? And so that's why everyone gets a focused professional practice evaluation within 6 months of being privileged. That's why those are repeated. I think it's now going to be every 3 years. But there's also this idea of OPPE, or ongoing professional practice evaluation, which is that they establish metrics. And if you fall below that metric, it doesn't mean you're incompetent. It just means someone should look closer. You might have a surgeon whose return to OR is higher than the benchmark. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean... And then you go to the section and you say, what's going on? And they go, look, and they say, well... This person gets international referrals for super high risk patients that nobody else will touch. Yeah. So it's sort of reasonable to expect that if they're going to do surgeries on people no one else will touch, they might go back to the OR more often. It's not like we don't measure people's competency by a metric. We do use metrics as sort of an early warning system to say we should look a little closer. But that's how... So there's the initial process, and then there's this ongoing process. And I will tell you that because advanced practitioners are much newer to this space, right? Like, depending on your historiography, physicians have been around for somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 years, right? I once had dinner with one of the original PAs. And so our time window is so much shorter. We can't really rest on sort of this thousands of years of earned competency, we still have to prove it at a much higher level. And you see that in the Joint Commission, right? Mm-hmm. Joint Commission standards for ongoing evaluation of physicians are relatively cut and dried. When it comes to procedural privileges for APPs, they're very, very invested, particularly over the last 10 years. They want to know, how are you showing this competency? How are you showing ongoing competency? And so we are, in some ways, more under a microscope because we're still relatively new and because we don't have as many external structures to sort of prove what we can do.
Well, so that brings us to privileging. It seems like, and you tell me if I have this wrong, when you go through the privileging process, it looks like a list of things that you can ask for privileges to do. And it's usually two categories. One is sort of core privileges, they're often referred to, which is the normal stuff, writing notes, HMPs and such, ordering non-controlled substances, ordering lab tests, interpreting them, and so on. Really, which, I mean, it covers 98% of probably what you'd ever do, and which I would imagine anyone in any department doing anything needs to be able to do. It's the basic skills of practicing medicine. And presumably everyone needs that. I don't know how you would apply for privileges and not ask for that. That'd be crazy. And then there are additional special privileges, which are, for the most part, procedures. I mean, I'm not sure what would be non-procedural. Like, this one question you need privileges to ask in an H&P or something. That doesn't make sense. But it's usually procedures, and then you can decide, do I want to ask for privileges for this particular procedure that they have, that they've listed, basically. And if you do, then there may be a process of establishing that you know how to do it. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. That is actually the correct terminology. There are core and special privileges. And one way to think about it is core is stuff that you really should have gotten in school and that everyone should be able to do. And special are really things that you received additional training beyond what was necessary. Like, to be a PA, you don't have to be able to place a central line. To be a PA, you really ought to be able to do an H&P. And so, but you probably didn't learn how to do central lines in PA school. And so it's something that requires additional specialized training. It's supposed to be infrequent and high risk. So, you know, for example, I did not in school learn how to open the OmniCell. Does that mean I need an open the OmniCell privilege? No, because it's frequent and it's low risk. But placing a central line is infrequent relative to, you know, an H&P and high risk. If I do it wrong, I'm going to cause injury. So that's really how the regulatory agents think about it, which means there is actually a third category, which is there are procedures that can become core over time. So things that you might have needed to receive additional training, but then become part of your daily practice. We see this a lot in some of like implanted birth control. Like if you graduate from school and you've never done it, no one should let you do it blind, right? But after you've done it for a couple years and you do it every day, do we really need the same level of scrutiny that we use for something like an intubation, which is an infrequent high-risk event? So there's also a third mechanism where things can become core after you've established competency.
The list of special privileges for a certain, and these lists are different for different jobs, meaning different services, different departments applying for different types of jobs. It is unclear, often at least to me, whether the list of things is like a rule in or a rule out, meaning if something is not on that list, does it mean you can do it? Or does it mean you can't, no matter what, because you can't even apply for it? You'll never be able to do it. And it sounds like it sort of depends on the risk of the thing, but that sort of requires judgment. For instance, as an example, my current job, our privilege list includes many bedside procedures. For the APPs, it does not include bronchoscopy. So I'm pretty sure I can't do bronchs. But other things may occasionally come up where I'm like, well, it's not in the list. I think I'm allowed to do that. And it's just a matter of, like you said, opening the Pyxis is probably okay. But
yeah, that's a good question. Because, placing an NG tube I don't think is on my list of, right. I'm not credentialed for that, but I've done it.
Well, I think you're actually covered because you're a registered nurse still.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Saved.
No, but that raises a really good point. And the question is anyone in your group privileged to do it? So if the physicians are privileged to do bronchoscopy and you are not, then you're not able to do it. So it's something. The other thing is there are things that you may be uniquely, there's an appeals process where you can say, none of the other people in my group do this thing, but I do it, and here's my evidence of competence, and I would like to be able to do it. And so, you know, we see that not infrequently. And again, one of the things that happens with APPs is our license, we're more portable, right? We can change specialty much easier than our physician colleagues can. And I'll use a specific example. There was a PA who worked in oncology, and one of her core activities was to do bone marrow aspirates, right? I mean, that's like a core function. If you're a PA in oncology, you do bone marrow. She then moved to surgical oncology, where it would be really helpful if while the patient was under anesthesia for the surgical procedure, she went ahead and did the bone marrow aspirate. But that didn't appear on their privilege list because the surgeon didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And no one had really asked the question. So she was able to appeal and get that added to her privileges because she could establish that she had done it, that she was competent to do it. There was a benefit to allowing her to do it. And she had a mechanism for ensuring ongoing competence, which was, you know, the agreement of a member of the oncology service to come observe her periodically.
Yeah, it seems like the way things are listed, it seems very cut and dry, but in fact, there is real gray areas. How you define things, or even how you differentiate things. Like you said, central lines. If it just says central lines, so I suppose you could do any central line. But what if it says, you know, different sites, femoral, subclavian? Presumably that entails that if you're privileged for one, you can't do the others. But I mean, you could break it down further. What about dialysis catheters? Is that separately listed? If it's separate, I assume you need to be separately privileged for that. If it's not, I probably would assume that it's just like a central line. But you see, we're all just sort of making assumptions here.
Well, and that's one of the tricks. That's why you want clinicians on the credentialing committee to raise these questions. That actually is a huge internal debate in any credentialing committee, because a lot of places will say central lines by location, but no one really does that for art lines. Like, imagine the headache if you had to prove that you can place a line into every given artery you might place a line into. It'd become absurd. At the same time, you know, you might ask the question in young children, maybe dialysis catheters, because they're huge in kids relative, right? Like dialysis, the machines aren't, machines still need flow. So the size of a dialysis catheter in a 10-month-old relative to the size of their IJ is huge. It's vastly different. Mm-hmm. So that's also where you might say, hey, in kids under 5, we think this should be a special privilege. Once you're 5, meh, if you can place a central line, you're probably fine. It's nuanced. And the federal government doesn't tell you how to make that decision. And Joint Commission doesn't. What Joint Commission says is you have to have a process for making those decisions. And then once you make them, you have to stick to them. So if you say dialysis catheters is a separate procedure, you better ensure that there aren't people putting in dialysis catheters based on their central line privilege. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you don't make the distinction, you say a central line's a central line's a central line, then Joint Commission's going to hold you to, well, did you show that they were, like, they're going to hold you to what you set as your standard. They don't generally tell, they don't have the specific knowledge to do that.
Right. So, like, human beings are creating these categories, and you're sort of, you know, entrusting them to make them reasonably rational, but, you know, they may not always be complete. I mean, I've seen a lot of these lists where I'm like, this is real weird, but, you know, it is what it is, and you work around it. And I imagine it's not meant to be, like, a replacement for your own judgment. You know, if you're privileged to intubate people and you come across some very high-risk airway and you botch it up, you can't, well, you know, it said I could do it. I mean, you still need to, maybe you are not the person to do this intubation or this line or whatever.
What about learners, students, residents? I mean, I wasn't credentialed when I was a student and I did procedures under the supervision of someone who was. But like when I became an NP, suddenly now I can't place lines. I placed lines 2 days ago as a student and now I can't because I have to be credentialed. How does that work?
So I would distinguish between, yes, a trainee. And again, I want to distinguish between APP trainees and physician trainees, right? Because like, a resident and a fellow are physicians. But if you stay, like when I was a PA student, I could do X. No, you really couldn't. What you were doing is you were learning to do X under the direct supervision of someone who was qualified to do it. But when you were done doing it, they couldn't walk away and let you do the next one on your own.
For sure, yeah.
That's very different from when you became a nurse practitioner. Once they say you have this privilege, they don't have to watch you do it anymore. So there's a different standard. And so the answer to what you're asking is proctoring. So we use this is one of those terms that a lot of people use. Proctoring when it comes to privileges means something pretty specific. That means you're doing the procedure and someone else who's qualified to do it is watching you and able to step in if things go pear-shaped. But like just for an example, the first time you place a central line and you're proctored, let's say, by one of the attending physicians, technically you should actually submit that bill if you did the procedure, even if they watched you. mm-hmm. because they were proctoring you. They were not supervising. They were, that has a pretty specific meaning. And so when it comes to special procedures, the way you're supposed to do it is you should be proctored for a period of time until you establish competency, and then you should apply for the privilege independently. And every state, it gets a little nuanced, whether you're allowed to do that, what you're allowed to do. Every medical staff has different criteria, right? A lot of them are in the old school, do 10 of them poorly and you're now qualified. Our institution went to a competency-based. So it's less about the number and more about people who are good at this, willing to sign their name saying, I watch this person and they're good at it. Mm-hmm. But either ways, again, the Joint Commission doesn't tell you how to do it. They just say you have to have a process, a proctoring policy, and you have to follow that policy.
And the a person who is privileged to do the procedure can proctor, I mean, I guess everyone might have their own policies, but in principle, they could proctor anyone. It's not like there's a list of privileges to learn and then.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So let me add this, and because I think it may get to Brandon's question. Let's say Brandon's group, they just don't bronk very often. That's why he's not privileged to bronk. And one day he's in the unit, and the attending says, "I'm going to do a bronk. Do you want to do this bronk? I mean, we don't ever do them. Do you want to do it just for the fun and experience of it? And I'll proctor you." Can he do that because he's not?
It depends.
He's not in the process of being privileged, right? So it's one thing to say I'm not fully independently privileged yet, but I'm in that process and being proctored.
You don't have to like send a letter saying I'm going to learn how to do this.
Yeah, can he just like as a one-off do it with somebody watching him?
Not really. You have to have a proctoring policy, and so if that proctoring policy says. There may be procedures that they are not currently privileged to perform that they may be proctored in based on the needs of the service, mm-hmm. then you just have to be covered. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Like what happens if your group decides, well, we're actually going to move to doing broncs at 4 a.m. so that the results are available when the attending gets in the morning, and because we're a rational group of people, the attendings go home, and so we need to now privilege our APPs to do broncs, you're going to start from zero. And maybe what they say is, well, I'd like to see if that's even feasible. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try it, right? We're going to trial it. We're going to try to teach them to do broncs. Maybe we're going to do a simulated one. Then we're going to walk them through a proctored to see whether this is realistic. You could formulate a proctoring policy that would allow you to do that. But you need to have a policy that explains what you're doing and why you're doing it. You can't just one day a new attending comes in where the APPs did broncs at the place they were at before mm-hmm. and said, dude, let's just go do this. 30 years ago, sure, right? It was see one, do one, teach one. That doesn't really fly anymore.
So there is actually a policy that answers these questions anywhere in particular, which probably
yes.
nobody has read, but it does exist. How are you supposed to do this?
Yes, somewhere within your medical staff office and in your policies and procedures, you can find what the proctoring policy is.
And I imagine maybe in some very high-risk cases, it might even be more structured than this. Like the first time you learn to do this, can't just be doing it. You need to do it on like a simulator or some kind of more structured mm-hmm. way, you know, before you like, I don't know, decapitate somebody and turn their head around or something like that. I mean, there's a really specific way to learn.
Well, and, you know, one of the things we don't think about a lot, but to bring it to physicians, a lot of surgeons are doing a procedure that's never been done in that institution before, mm-hmm. right? It's a new procedure. Like the machine didn't exist last year. They will sometimes bring in an external surgeon to proctor them, to say someone who's done this, to say, yes, I'm watching this person do this and they are competent to keep doing it. Like proctoring doesn't just involve APPs. It's really any time there's a question of how do we show that this person is competent to do this thing they didn't train on during their formal educational processes.
All right. So, I mean, I'm curious about that as well, how this process differs for physicians, because it sounds like the way you're describing it, if a skill is considered to be within the core competencies of a certain specialty, like any general surgeon learned how to do an appendectomy, it's not going to be separately listed as its own privilege. But anything that may be considered more you know, some people can, some people can't, then it might be? Is that?
It still may be listed under their core privileges as a call out, right? Because there's a lot of discussion. There's so many different routes. Like, there's so many different ways to become a pediatric neurologist. Like, you may not know this, but there's a bunch of different routes. And they may have different skill sets. There's also, you know, the ENT, there are pediatric ENT docs, but there are also ENTs that did a whole bunch of peds cases. And so something may be core, but still called out. The difference is they're not being trained in your facility to do this. They came with a piece of paper from their fellowship, from their residency, and a procedure log and a letter that said, this person is qualified to do this. Mm-hmm. They may still have to go through some initial proctoring if it's a high-risk procedure. One of the areas that's really different is because they had this formal training and this nationally recognized, right, ACGME approved, whatever it is, they're not subject to as much scrutiny over time. So I have to show every 3 years I'm still competent to place a central line. The board certified pediatric intensivists do not. I have to show, because that's one of the procedures that is considered core to their fellowship. They had to demonstrate competency. So that's what I mean when I say sometimes we're under more scrutiny. I don't want to lie. We don't get the same presumption of competency over time. Mm-hmm. As APPs, we just don't. So I've been placing central lines for 24 years. I've done, because of the era I trained in, you know, geometrically more than any attending I work with. And yet I still every 3 years have to have one of them look at me do it, including people I taught to do it, and say, yep, still competent. And that's just the nature of the beast. That comes from being a relatively new profession without the same robust regulatory structures, measures of competency, board certifications. And I think you can make lots of arguments why we don't want to duplicate all those processes. Mm-hmm. But it does come with a cost. The fact that you can change careers much easier means that there's going to be heightened scrutiny in every career you choose.
And just to, I guess, reiterate one of the original points, everything we're talking about is based around specific institutions, hospitals, really, for mm-hmm. what we do. This is not about laws. The law in the state you practice may not say anything about any of this. I mean, there may be things that it says you can or can't do, but for the most part, they're much more broad. I'm sure there are no laws in my state about whether I can place central lines. I mean, maybe some very inclusive language that makes it possible. But for a hospital to say, we think you can or can't do certain things is about the hospital. It's like you're mm-hmm. a guest in somebody's house and, you know, they want you to take off your shoes or something. There's no law about that. They're just saying, well, if you're working here, we want you to do things this way because it's also, you know, we're responsible for that. It's on our liability. This is what we're comfortable with. And therefore, these are the rules that we want you to follow. And it may be different, you know, at the other hospital across town. But
right. And I was going to say, it kind of all boils down to whatever the most restrictive policy is, right? Like, I'm sure, Brandon, you can do Bronx in other places, right? PA's in our hospital, Bronx. But you can't where you are now. So, I mean, I tell students that just because as an acute care nurse practitioner, you can intubate people, doesn't mean you're going to be able to intubate people in your job. The hospital may say, no, you can't do that, right?
And, I mean, that's like any other regulatory agency, right? You can always be more restrictive than the agency above you, right? So the state of Colorado can be more restrictive than CMS, but they can't be less restrictive.
Right.
The hospital can be more restrictive than the state, but they can't be less restrictive. So there are where you will often find state law influencing is when it comes to areas about, quote, supervision. So some in Colorado, for example, up until 2023, I could not have a special privilege that my, quote, supervising physician did not have. So if my supervising physician could not place central lines, I could not be privileged to place central lines. Mm. That was a Colorado-specific rule that may or may not have been the difference anywhere. That's one of the things we changed in 2023 is the state legislature changed that and said, no, you can be privileged to do the things you are qualified to do and can show competency in. And I want to be very clear. That's outside the OR. inside the OR is it's a whole different beast. And you should really have someone on who specializes in that area if you want to talk about that, because there are absolutely restrictions. I cannot perform surgery. I can't be the person, I'm never going to be privileged for a variety of different rules, laws, et cetera, a lot of which is actually regulated by nursing about who can do certain things. And so when it gets to the operating room, the rules are very, very different. And I think that's important to keep in mind. We all know the story of the surgeon and the PA, where the surgeon walks in, sort of touches the patient, and then the PA performs the bulk of the procedure. If that surgeon doesn't show up, that PA is not touching that patient. And so it is really important when it gets to the OR, it's its own beast.
Let me ask you about emergencies, because there may be times when something needs to be done to save a life and nobody is present who actually has privileges to do it. And the way that it's always been described to me, and the wording is fairly specific here, if somebody is dying and nobody is present who is privileged to do the thing that will save their life, the most trained person can do it if they are competent to do it. And it's not suggesting that someone should do it who doesn't know how, but if they do have the appropriate training, then they can and perhaps should, despite the fact that they don't have privileges. I've never heard of someone suggesting that's not the case. In other words, someone saying that you shouldn't have done that because you don't have the privilege to do it. I have heard of people saying you shouldn't have done that because you could have waited for someone who's privileged, an argument about timing, or saying you did it wrong. I mean, that's always possible. But would you agree with that framing?
So I would caution that I'm not an attorney, and this gets awfully close to legal advice. Good Samaritan laws are vary from state to state. There's also the question of what's legal and what's likely. And what I would suggest is that if the life-saving procedure saves the life, you're very unlikely to end up in a court. Mm-hmm. And if the life-saving procedure does not save a life, there's a decent chance you will end up in court even if you did everything correctly. So it's really a question of, this is where it comes down to being an individual. This is why I'm glad I'm a member of medical staff. Because I can tell you, as a hospital employed, clinical, whatever, nurse, RT, whatever, if you do something that's not listed, no, you're practicing outside scope, right? You can't do something that, I'm married to a nurse, I've watched the process she goes through. It's very if you're going to do this, you go through the checklist and then you're certified and you say, yes, you can do this. And then it's something you can do. And if it's not on the list of things you can do, they are very strict that no, you cannot do that unless it's on the list of things you can do. We have, as clinicians, always been given a little bit more freedom. And so it's much less black and white. Can I do things? One of the things that comes up all the time, right? Can I place an IV? Does it say anywhere in my privileges I can place an IV? No. Mm-hmm. Can I place an IV? Yes. Am I pretty good at it? Yes. So do I need to be privileged to place an IV? No. If a patient needs a tracheostomy and there's no one within 100 miles who can perform a tracheostomy, and once back when you were an independent duty corpsman 15 years ago, you tracheostomized a goat, but you're the most qualified person and the patient's going to die, would you probably be covered by Good Samaritan laws? Probably. Would you want to make damn sure the person standing next to you isn't a secret ENT who could have done it? Yeah. Right? I mean, you better be really, really sure there is no one qualified to do something. And I do think in our modern institutions, barring some sort of natural disaster, where I think, again, there were people who did things during Hurricane Katrina they were not medically qualified to do because there was no one else around to do them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very different. You'd have to be pretty gutsy to go after someone in the middle of a natural disaster who is trying their best.
Well, it's interesting. Now that I think about it, some of the procedures that are maybe most likely for this to come up, true rescue kinds of things where, seconds could be of the essence, I feel like a lot of the time I have not even seen them on privilege lists. And I'm thinking of things like a needle decompression for pneumothorax, IOs sometimes, maybe placement of like rescue airways like LMAs, or even, I mean, maybe even like bag valve mask ventilation. I often haven't even seen these on lists. And maybe that actually makes it easier to argue that, you know, it was reasonable to do it in an emergency because it doesn't say you can't do it. And like we were sort of saying, there's sort of a gray area on what is. Now, does that mean you would do it in a non-emergency? Probably not. But
I would ask you, does your privileging say anywhere that you're required to maintain ATLS or ACLS or PALS or NRP? Because for us, the reason none of that's included is because we're required to maintain PALS certification, and PALS teaches us, right, quote unquote, to do all those things. So this is where all that verification that they do that it's so annoying is super helpful. If PALS says, like, I don't have to be privileged to order epi, right? Like, should a general pediatrician be ordering epi? Probably not. But they're not required to maintain PALS. I am. I'm required to maintain ACLS now because so many of our patients are over 18. There's been debate as to whether we're seeing so many very young children, we should be NRP certified. So sometimes it's a certification that includes something that allows us to do it as well, right? Sure. If you are ACLS certified and you place an IO and they say, well, where's that on your privileges? You can point to where it says I'm required to maintain ACLS certification and I passed my ACLS within the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. I bet the AHA would say that we're not in the business of demonstrating people have competence placing IOs after our courses, though.
Nevertheless, that is how, again, this is what they look for, right? Like, am I 100% sure that acupuncture accrediting body was held people to the same standards that I was held to in PA school? Maybe not. But I went to PA school a long, long time ago, and they really emphasized the physical exam. My entire first year, I had a physical exam test every Friday with a proctor. And I was, you know, I had to get every single one of the items on my checklist right, or I had to come back in on Saturday morning and repeat it. And do I think some of the current PA schools are holding people to that standard? No. Are we both graduating with the same license and the same certification? Yes. Right? There's always going to be some variability. I do think you get enough in PALS to at least be able to say, look, I'm PALS certified. This patient needed something that I knew how to do. And this is why I felt competent doing it.
Yeah. And I suppose, just to reemphasize, all of these, you know, regulations in general should probably be viewed as a floor, meaning not that you should do more, but in many cases that you should do less. The fact that you technically are allowed to do something according to your privileging doesn't mean that you always should. In many cases, you should not, based on your own judgment of a situation. And this applies even within the core realm. You know, if you technically could, you know, guide the care of a patient as far as prescribing their meds and things, maybe there are times when you should not be the one doing that on your own. You know, you need to apply a little bit of judgment to any particular situation in addition to asking the question of what you're technically allowed to do by the law, by your hospital, and so on.
As APPs, we spend a lot more time talking about know your limits, but all of us really should. Every member of the medical staff should acknowledge that they have limits, you know, that we're not all as good as everything as someone else might be at one thing. And part of our obligation is to say, I'm not the best person to do this. You know, let me go find the best person to do this. I'm not the right person to do this. You know, a lot of us, as I get older, I'm starting to struggle with the fact, what happens when I start to feel like I probably shouldn't be doing things I did forever because my motor skills are not what they were when I was 21. To try and build a system to check my motor skills every day would be absurd. Mm-hmm. You somewhat have to rely on being honest with yourself. And this is maybe where it's sort of nice to be an APP, is we've sort of been given permission for the last 60 whatever years to say, I have a limit. And when I exceed that limit, I go get somebody else. And I think for a lot of physicians, as the amount of information is so extraordinary, as the amount of skills has become so extraordinary, right? As medical knowledge has infinitely expanded, to give them permission to say, I don't know, let me go find someone who does, I think is going to be really challenging. But we all have to do that because it's a privilege. Like, I know it's a stupid word, but it is a privilege. We don't have a right to be there. It's a privilege to take care of critically ill children. It's a privilege I have to honor every single day by showing up and by knowing when I shouldn't show up, right? This goes back to basic things like don't come to work sick. Like the biggest challenge in medicine, right? Convincing medical providers not to come to work sick. And all of this is very similar. Know your limits. Do the right thing for your patient.
Brian, what else do you want to talk about?
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of this all just kind of comes down on the legal end of things too. As long as there is an accepted process in your facility and you follow it. I feel like there's a lot of joint commission policy even is that we're not going to necessarily dictate to you how to do everything as long as you have a process in place that's reasonable and you do it.
Right. You could say everyone whose name is Jim is credentialed to place lines.
Yeah.
That'd be sort of silly, but as long as you follow that process.
That's why it's so important to have clinicians involved in this process is because what's reasonable to us may not be what seems reasonable to people who don't do this every day. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's really important that you have people who live it looking at the process. It's also like, I know we sort of divorce administration from clinical care, but it's the same thing, which is question the process. You should question your administrative processes just like you question your clinical processes. Is what we're doing still making sense? Mm-hmm. You know, are we following a process that's 30 years out of date? Because the other thing people do is they just tend to accept administrative processes as policy. Oh, it's policy. Well, if the policy's harming children, we should fix the policy. And I know you guys do adults, and I guess adults are entitled to care too. I don't know. I don't spend much time thinking about it. But like, it's very clear with kids, right? If this policy is harming children, the policy needs to change, not the kids. And I think that's the other thing is we do, if you disagree with what some article says you should do about asthma, you're not just going to blindly follow it. You're going to say, I disagree. Let's think about this some more. But when someone sends you that 26-page packet and you fill it out and you go, this thing you're asking me for makes no sense, we go, well, but it's the policy, and so we fill it out. So if there's one thing to take away is if the policy doesn't make any sense, it's still okay to question the process. None of us know everything. There is no golden rule book that explains how to do this. Every medical staff office is trying their best to do what's right for patients. And they love it when people get engaged and say, hey, I actually think there might be a better way to do this. They love that because they often feel the opposite of what you, right? Like they're the person sending the paperwork you don't want to hear from. Mm-hmm. They're coming to work every day trying to make sure that patients get the best care they can. If you think you have a better way, engage with them.
And that gets back to the question of whether you are just subject to these people's decisions or are you actually a member of the medical staff that can guide some of this, which is probably something that you didn't care about when you were just getting the paperwork, but now that you have a problem with the process, there is much more.
Right. Yeah.
Is it like, was it taxation without representation or do you have a say?
Yeah,
I mean, this impacts your life, right? The things we just talked about for the last, hour, they impact your daily life. They tell you what you can and cannot do. And if you're hitting friction in that, you have the ability to say, hey, I think we should do it differently. And that is one of the core concepts of the medical staff is it's an engaged staff. It's people who are part of the process. Bylaws changes have to be approved by the medical staff. That's where it gets in a little tricky of are you a voting member or not a voting member, all that sort of esoteric stuff. But if you are a voting member of your medical staff, I would encourage you to not take it for granted. That's actually a considerable amount of power to make your life easier.
All right. Well, let's wrap it there. Thank you so much for your help in kind of shine the light behind this confusing process. I think it's helpful for people, even if they try to limit how much they engage with all this, to at least understand the framework of what regulates the work that they do. We'll talk to you guys next time.